Man, you must do so much weeding.
Do you know the weed pressure we face in McKernan?
Oh my God, I can't even imagine. Just the dandelions alone.
Like, I don't know how much we've talked about this, but when we bought our house, the front yard had six enormous trees, like a spruce and pine and a willow, that just like towered over the house. Like you couldn't even see the house from the road hardly.
Right.
We had ambitious plans for our yard, and we cut those trees down to make room for more interesting plants. But then like we didn't really have a plan, and we didn't swoop in and lay sod and plant and all that. So it like became a vacant lot, basically, that was like succumbed to the many weed pressures of older neighborhoods, like the Manitoba maples and the dandelions and the elm seedlings and, you know, a million other things.
Mm-hmm. Thistles and whatever those weird ones that look like wild onions, but they're not actually wild onions.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Oh, I have some in my backyard.
So we kind of like built our yard on top of all that. And so like we've been waging various battles. Like we had a pretty vicious thistle battle that actually ended last year. Like we've like basically vanquished thistle from the front yard.
Whoa.
But there's others that are much more insidious, like quack grass and stuff like that. But,
oh yeah. Quack grass. Who cares about quack grass though?
Well, if you're gunning for Front Yards and Bloom Awards, then you care about quack grass. Just kidding.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with Alan Sutterby.
Hi.
Hi, Alan. We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food and we love to talk about it. Now I'm going to make fun of more recipes. Did you eat anything good this week, Alan?
Well, yep.
Yeah?
Well, most importantly, I made butter tarts.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Sweet.
At the beginning of our last conversation, I like talked about or revealed some of my like my unease with this format, in that like I can't spontaneously fact check. And honestly, about like 10 times a recording, I'm like, I don't know if what I just said is 100% correct, or at least I'm not able to like provide the source that I would like to. But anyways, so there's a few things that I said last time that I would like to go over again briefly, but the butter tarts is an important one.
Okay.
Because we had this weird conversation where you asked me if butter tarts are a Canadian dish, and I said, nope, they're a regional specialty of Ontario. And then I said, I was born and raised in Ontario, and I had never heard of them until I was in my 20s living in Alberta, which is a weird thing to say.
That was a weird thing to say.
And then, so I ended up.
And I told you that my mom made butter tarts like since I was a little kid, and she's from Red Deer.
Yeah.
You were like, oh.
So she must have Ontarian ancestry. I'm just kidding.
I mean, maybe.
But I talked to my parents about this, and I asked them, like, did we eat something called butter tarts? Do we eat something called butter tarts when we were little? And they were like, yes. And I was like, yeah, but like, were they as common as like Nanaimo bars and date squares and brownies and stuff? And they were like, yes. And I said, yeah, but did we call them something else, or like was there like a different name we used for them? And they said no.
You just don't remember butter tarts.
So I don't know what happened, like, but yeah, they made it seem like it was inconceivable that I would not know about them, because I almost certainly ate them as a child.
Yeah.
One interesting thing though is that my mom said, so yeah, they would have been everywhere at like family functions and church functions and stuff like that. But she said she would occasionally buy them from M&M's meat shops, but she almost never made them.
Okay.
I don't know if this was meant to be the reason that they were not made in our house, but either my mom or my dad mentioned that my mom really likes them with raisins in them, and my dad can't stand them with raisins in them. So there's some kind of really bitter
tale as old as time,
decades long feud kind of between my mom and dad, and maybe that's why they were never present in my home. But anyway, so as a you asked if I had eaten anything good this week, so as a kind of like penance or like for being from Ontario and then having this weird conversation where I said I had never heard of them, my mom sent me pictures of the butter tarts recipes from Best of Ridge. Don't worry, Shale.
Okay.
Best of Ridge.
Yeah.
And nice. And Gene Perry, like the Company's Coming series.
Company's Coming. Wow. Both.
Yeah.
Did you, and are they similar?
They're identical. They're if you scale them to the same yield, they're basically identical. One of them has lemon juice and one doesn't. But like the ratio of brown sugar to eggs to butter is, I think, identical if you scale them down.
They must have gotten it from Michael Ruhlman.
Well, actually, okay, we should do an episode just on butter tarts, man, because like I went through that Anita Stewart's Canada book to see what they had to say about butter tarts, and they talk about the entire like genealogy of the recipe. Like they had the first published recipe was in 1900, somewhere in Eastern Canada. So it has relatively deep roots. I took the parts of the two recipes that I liked best and made my own version. But I did some of the chef-y things. Like I browned the butter.
Ooh.
Oh, I think maybe I increased the butter because it seemed like a pretty silly small amount for something called butter tarts. But I browned the butter and...
That's what happens with people who try to make butter chicken too, Alan.
What do you mean?
They put all kinds of butter in it.
Oh, and then you're like, this doesn't come out right at all.
Why isn't this like butter chicken? Because there's not really butter in that.
There's no butter in butter chicken?
No, I wouldn't say that. There probably is some butter. There's probably a fair amount.
But it's more about like yogurt marinade and stuff, or
it's like yogurt and a specific kind of curry. Mm. And, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But the most ridiculous thing about every butter tarts recipe that I read over the last week is that none of them have salt in them.
Oh, that's
like none of them have salt in the filling, which is ridiculous.
Yeah, that is ridiculous. Yeah, it doesn't surprise me either.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like in the recipes that you're talking about, like in Company's Coming and Best of Bridge, like putting salt in sweet things probably would seem weird to people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Back then. And they would be like, salt? Put salt in my dessert? That doesn't make sense.
But is there salt in like the cake recipes?
There must be, right? There must. I don't know.
I'll look into it. I'll get back to you. But yeah, adding salt to sweets. Yeah, I don't think that wasn't part of that culture.
Yeah, exactly. I think it would come off as being weird or something. I mean, in the cake, maybe not so much because I don't know. But yeah,
but
I can see how it was omitted, and probably none in like the tart shell either.
That's a good you know what, so the recipes for like from Company's Coming and Best of Bridge, like they just call for tart shells, so presume I like in my mind in my mind like there's a specific frozen maybe par baked tart shell that came in a little foil it's like single-use dish like in a sleeve of them.
Gotcha.
I'm assuming that's what they are referring to when they ask for a tart shell, or when they ask for 36 tart shells.
Yeah.
So I just used my own
butter tarts. She always made her own.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Crust. Yeah.
So she's hardcore. I get it.
Yep.
Flaky or more like short dough cookie like, or what?
Flaky. Yeah. Like really flaky. But I don't know. My mom's butter tart is like an interesting. It usually had currants in it.
Yep.
Which, is like sometimes a thing, sometimes not a thing. But yeah, that was for me. The ones that I grew up on had dried currants. And the shell was like, I would say looking back on it now, well, maybe underbaked isn't quite the right way of putting it. But like baked in such a way that they didn't take on a lot of color, but they're still really flaky.
Mm-hmm.
And so they weren't like, when you ate them, they wouldn't like fall apart because they were so flaky.
Mm-hmm.
They would kind of like, they were flaky, but it would, but the tart shell would kind of like still hold together while you're eating it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway,
I did two.
It's a very specific situation.
Yeah. I tried two different crusts. I tried like a pâte sucrée, just the one from the Duchess cookbook.
Uh-huh.
And I did my, just like my North American style pie dough, like really flaky, crispy.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the flaky, crispy pie dough is way better.
Yeah, that's the way to do it, for sure.
It's much more, people from Ontario will find it irritating that I'm using this comparison, but like it makes it much more like a Portuguese custard tart. Like,
right.
And a really great textural contrast between like, crispy, flaky, layered pastry kind of, and the custard, the filling.
Oh my God, I love egg tarts.
Yeah.
So good. What other follow-up do we have, Alan? You said there was some other stuff that you wanted to talk about from last episode.
When you were disambiguating bacon nomenclature as it's used in America, Canada, and the United Kingdom, we at the end of that, we were wondering, so if you just say the word bacon in the UK, what are you referring to?
Yeah.
And so I asked my friend Elise Chatterton, who is a UK, what is she? She's a master butcher. Trained and worked in the UK for many years, but now works out of Edmonton. I think she's at Papa Witch's Meat right now, but knows her way around the butcher block. And she said that in England, if you say bacon, it means back bacon, and specifically it means unsmoked back bacon, which would be an important distinction for a North American. She said, like, there are three kind of main styles available. The back bacon, the streaky bacon, like you said, made from the belly, and then middle bacon, which is like the belly rolled around the loin.
Gotcha.
And typically all of those would be unsmoked. You can get some smoked bacon, but it would be cold smoked. So you'd still be purchasing it raw, which I thought was interesting.
Right.
And she also mentioned that streaky bacon, she thought that in the UK, streaky bacon, or like our belly bacon, is basically only used for wrapping like sausages and lean meats, like barding, like covering chicken or turkey in fatty bacon to cook it.
They don't just eat that with their breakfast.
Apparently not. Yeah.
But they will eat brown beans with their breakfast.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think I have this figured out.
So that was one. Yeah. It was just kind of a question we had that.
Yeah, totally. And then that makes kind of a lot more sense because that probably means that there were a lot of Canadians that referred to it that way as well.
Right.
And then that might be why the Americans wound up calling it Canadian bacon, because Canadians were calling back bacon bacon.
Do you mean because of their British ancestry?
Because the Queen. They didn't want to upset the Queen.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, Alan, the monarchy. It's a big deal.
The other... Oh, there's kind of, I don't know what you would call this, a loose end or something, but I had mentioned, we were talking about the Marco Polo myth that Polo brought pasta.
Where I was pretty certain that Marco Polo brought spaghetti to Italy from China.
Yeah. And so I had said that I dimly remembered that being part, someone saying that that had been part of a pasta advertising campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about, like, shortly after I said that, I was trying to think of where I heard that. And I thought at first that there was an episode of, what's the Terry O'Reilly show on the CBC about advertising?
Well, he's had a couple different names for
Under the Influence is what I'm thinking of.
Right. Yeah.
I thought that I heard it on that. I searched and couldn't find anything to that effect, but then eventually came across, if you're playing the food court drinking game, you have to drink now, because I'm mentioning Jeffrey Steingarten in one of his essays called Hail Cesare, he mentions that there was an English food writer named Jane Grigson who thought that the Marco Polo myth was developed by a Canadian pasta company in the 1920s for advertising purposes. So he makes that reference. And now that reference is all over the internet. It's quoted on the Wikipedia page for pasta.
Right. Okay.
But no one has linked to the original Jane Grigson comment. Like, it's not
right.
It's even odd to me that Steingarten doesn't say what piece of writing she says that in, mm-hmm. or maybe it's just something she told him. I don't know.
Yeah.
But so that's odd. And that's another example of, we were talking about how just like things just, once it's on the internet, people just copy and paste it, and it kind of like,
yeah, and then it's all over the place. And then do you, yeah, exactly. And then can you cite a source for it? Can you find a source for it? I mean, like, potentially, but you know.
So there is one thing though. If you can cut this out if you want, but if you'll permit me,
I will.
There, someone does mention, not in relation to the Jane Grigson Marco Polo belief, but someone mentions that in the Macaroni Journal, which sounds like a made up publication, in the Macaroni Journal in 1929, there was a story published about how one of Marco Polo's sailors saw noodles being made in China and brought it back to the ship and taught them how to make it and brought it back to Italy. Uh-huh. And that's not, I was like, the Macaroni Journal, that's not a real thing. Obviously, that's not a real thing. But sure enough, you can go. Okay, so the Macaroni Journal was a trade publication for people selling semolina flour and
amazing
pasta machines and pasta dyes. And they actually have all of their back issues back to the 20s and earlier on their website.
No way.
So you can, I went on this website and I looked at the Macaroni Journal from October of 1929.
Okay.
And sure enough, there's this article in it called A Saga of Cathay, which is like an old, like medieval European kind of poetical name for China.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's this story about this sailor, guess what the sailor's name is? Working for Marco Polo on the Marco Polo ship off the shores of China. Guess what the sailor's name is? Don't think too hard.
No, I don't know.
It's Spaghetti.
Oh my God. Shut up.
This
is too good.
Marco Polo's ships are running out of fresh water. And so he needs to send a scouting team to shore to find fresh water. One of the men is named Spaghetti. And while he's looking for the water, he sees villagers, you know, preparing flour and water and stretching it into long sticks and drying it out. And he approaches them and sees its benefit for use on the ship and takes some back and works with it and feeds the crew and then goes back to Italy and opens a spaghetti factory. And so this is like a story just in the middle of one of these Macaroni Journals. Like, there's like stories on either side of it about like how to market pasta and like who's filed for patents and trademarks in the field recently. And then there's just this story called A Saga of Cathay. And at the end of the story, it just says copyright 1928 Keystone Macaroni Manufacturing Company, Lebanon, Pennsylvania. So it's just like a made up story that this pasta company put in the trade journal that became like an urban legend, right? Basically, I mean,
yeah,
I don't have any evidence that that's
seemingly
the first,
yeah, right?
I don't know if like, that's the first
seemingly it's just
it.
a fiction.
Yes,
like that's, yeah, the, you know, that's the first thing that's popping into my head. Somebody just like made up this story and then they're like, oh yeah, and there was a guy on the boat and his name was Spaghetti.
Yes.
And Marco Polo said, Spaghetti, go find the water.
Yeah. This is starting to remind me a lot of one of the movies we're talking about today.
Yeah, no kidding. I can't help but Google the etymology of the word spaghetti right now. I'm sorry, I just have to do this. Okay. I can't continue.
It's an Italian surname, obviously.
Yeah, let's find out, shall we? Yeah, this is what I thought. Because every pasta is named after its shape.
Right.
Right? Like, or most pastas are named after their shape. Spaghetti is the Italian plural of the diminutive of spago, which is string. So this guy's name was Little String.
Listen, he comes
and then
from
he went and discovered the noodles.
He comes from a long line of thread makers.
That's right.
Spinsters.
It's just pure coincidence that he happened to see them making these long, thin pasta strings.
I don't. In its defense, I don't really think that the what I called the article is intended as a strict
intended
history.
To be. Yeah, yeah. It's more just like a special interest story or like a little like fictional account that they just throw in there as entertainment or something.
I think like I do think that they use the words legend has it and stuff like that. But just like they in doing this, I don't know how intentional it was, but yeah, they kind of planted the seed for a story that would appear in ads and popular culture for decades, I
think. Yeah, no kidding. Until I said it on a podcast, stupidly. Now here we are. I mean, at least we have access to a lot of information about it. Mm-hmm. That's good. What else, Alan? Any more follow-up?
Yeah, the only other one was we talked briefly about Bannock.
Oh, yeah.
And right. I had said... Oh, yeah. So I didn't know if there was actually like a culinary lineage between the two, mm-hmm. but I had said that I knew that bannock was a term in the Scottish kitchen, like in baking. And I had said that bannock and scone could be more or less the same dough, but that bannocks were the small individual sized portions and the scones were the large, more like loaves, I guess. But it's actually the opposite of that.
Yeah. Which makes sense when you think about it.
Yeah, when you think about what a scone is. What a scone is.
Exactly.
I'll just read, there's one sentence I'll read. In modern usage, the bannock is the large round scone about the circumference of a meat plate, which is baked on the girdle, which is what Scots call griddles, I guess. When the bannock is cut into sections before being fired, or when the dough is cut into small rounds, you have scones. So that's from that the Scots Kitchen cookbook I mentioned last week by F. Mary and McNeil.
Cool. Thanks, F. Mary.
What was your follow-up?
Well, we have, should we call it letters from listeners?
Okay.
Listener Mike writes in, and he did me the favor when he wrote the letter of phrasing it exactly that way.
Okay. That's his salutation. That's great.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm going to read it verbatim. Listener Mike writes in, on the stereotype Canadian food of wild game, totally agree. And I always find it weird. In heavy tourism traffic places like Banff and Jasper, almost every restaurant has some sort of venison, elk, rabbit dish on the menu, placed right in the middle of a national park meant to conserve animals. Would you feel odd eating elk sirloin staring out the window at elk grazing on patches of grass not 50 feet from you? And I totally agree, and I think it's like super weird, but that is exactly sort of what I was making reference to when I kind of brought that up as a stereotype. Mm-hmm. And any of the restaurants that I've worked in those types of situations have always had some kind of game on the menu, and yeah, I just find it super weird. Like, let's go to the park and taste its wares.
Well, okay, so if I were to answer that question, like, would I feel comfortable eating an animal that I'm looking at its live counterpart, or sorry, while I'm looking at its live counterpart, mm-hmm. the answer is no, depending on the, well, I guess it depends on the context. So like if I were, forget about national parks, uh-huh. if I were eating venison while in the country and I saw a deer, I wouldn't think that that's weird. I would understand that like what I'm eating is part of the land and it would help me feel closer to the place that I'm in. But in a national park, it's much different because mm-hmm. the game that's on the menu is not wild game from the national park.
No, it's so farmed outside the park.
Yeah,
but it's
exactly.
Like it's served in the park because of some sort of connotation around the idea that you're in a wild place.
Yes.
And so you can get wild game that isn't actually wild, but you know,
it's a charade, basically.
Necessarily tell you that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, I just find that it's this like weird game.
You're just full of those things.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a weird kind of mental gymnastics that they're playing with the diner, like, it, you know, to try and, I don't know, trick them into eating something that they wouldn't normally eat, or feeling like they're eating something special because they're in the park or something.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly it. I think that last part you said is exactly it. It's, to sell the romantic notion of the park as a wild place when, it's just, that's just not where that food is coming from at all.
It would be like very illegal for it to come from there. And in fact, like when you have a restaurant in the park, every single thing that you get is shipped in from outside the park. It's pretty crazy. Like, you know, you can't procure anything that comes from within the park. So everything that you order has to come from outside the park.
You just mean in terms of raw ingredients, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because obviously there's no farming in the parks and...
Exactly. Yeah. There's no farming and obviously you can't forage anything.
Right.
Or,
yeah. You
know, because it's illegal to... Yeah.
You could have value-added products that were produced in the park, presumably, right? Like in the town centers and stuff, but...
Yeah.
But no raw products. That makes sense. Yeah.
So, yeah. Thanks, listener Mike. I agree. Pretty weird.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's it for follow-up. So, do we have a topic this week?
Yeah. Well, the topic was... Okay, so when we did the episode on our favorite food movies...
Mm-hmm.
I think we started off in, I can't remember what you asked, but I basically listed every movie about food that I knew, and I think there was three.
Right.
Which I was kind of embarrassed about. And then I can't remember what I think I said Ratatouille, Babette's Feast, and Chef.
Right.
And then you mentioned...
And Limitless?
Oh, yeah. Then you mentioned Burnt. Is that the connection you're making?
Yeah.
So the Bradley Cooper... movie Burnt, which I watched and I think we briefly discussed later. And then you also mentioned, here's something I wanted to talk about. You also mentioned The Big Night.
Oh yeah. Sorry. My bad. It's actually called Big Night,
which is, is a little,
Alan, I've been kicking myself about that for like 6 weeks. You don't have to bring it up on the air. Oh my God. How embarrassing. Yeah.
You mentioned Big Night, which I hadn't seen. And then, just because we had been talking about it, and I felt foolish that I didn't bring more to that conversation, just in terms of, movie suggestions, I did come across some other suggestions, from people and from reading, and they were, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman.
Right.
Which is an An Lee movie from the 90s.
Yeah. Which I have seen, but it was such a long time ago. I can't even really remember it at all.
Yeah. I managed to get that one from the public library. That we can talk about that later. But anyways, I just thought that because I just thought there was more room for a conversation for food movies. And so we had floated the idea of the next two favorites on the list would be Big Night and Eat, Drink, Man. Chef. Just kidding. Chef. Yeah, Chef. I wanted to trip you up and see if you would freak out because you haven't seen Eat, Drink, Man, Woman in a long time.
Oh, no.
Big Night and Chef. That was the idea.
Yeah.
Do you still want to do that?
Totally. Yeah, that's exactly what I want to do. Okay. And I watched both of those movies this week.
Oh, good.
Did you?
I watched Big Night, so it'd be the second time.
Mm-hmm.
Chef, I did not watch in the last week, but I think I...
Remember it pretty well?
I think I got it, yeah.
I actually... When I rewatched it this week, I think this is pretty common for me. After watching most movies, I think I pretty much like completely forget like 90% of the content. But yeah, when I was rewatching it, I was like, "Oh yeah,
right, yeah,"
and "Oh yeah, right." Yeah. Now I remember. Like, yeah, there's that. Yeah, like one of the pivotal scenes in the movie is when he marches into his dining room and, you know, berates the food critic that's in there and everyone catches it and posts it on social media.
Yeah.
And like, I can't remember if we talked about it on the podcast or not, but you brought that up with me at one point and I was like, man, I do not remember that at all.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
And now after having rewatched it, it seems so crazy that I didn't remember that because it's basically what the movie is about.
Yeah.
And yeah, somehow I just, you know, like I remembered I remembered some of the cooking scenes from the beginning, and I sort of remembered that it was about his relationship. It was kind of about the main character's relationship with his son.
Yeah.
But yeah, aside from that, and the fact that they bought a food truck and made Cuban sandwiches,
right,
that was pretty much all I remembered. So
yeah,
it was kind of nice to like watch it again. And I mean, it's a pretty good movie, and yeah, I barely remembered any of it, so it's pretty fun to rewatch it.
I didn't watch it in the last week, but I have seen it relatively recently, and I know that I liked it way more the last time I watched it than I did the first time. I don't know if there was something I had some kind of the first time I watched it, the ending really spoiled it for me. There was almost,
oh really,
like it was like a fairy tale ending.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was like too cool to like, I'm supposed to be like the like a hard jaded cook, and I was like, really?
Right.
Sorry, are we worrying about spoilers and stuff? We're not, right?
Well, we're not worrying about spoilers, but maybe if we're going to talk about the ending, maybe we should just like go through the movie a little bit before we get there or something. I don't know. What do you think? Like, it's sort of, because if people who haven't seen it are listening, it's probably not going to mean a lot to them if you just like talk about the end of the movie.
Everybody dies. Oh. Yeah. Okay. So really brief synopsis of the movie.
Or Chef. Let's just give a brief synopsis before we get into talking about the ending.
Okay.
Do you want to do it or should I?
I'll start and you can jump in as I make errors.
Okay. Sounds good.
So Chef Carl Casper is working.
Oh my God. You remembered his name.
At a restaurant. He's a chef working in LA. A big time food blogger and critic comes in. And if I remember right, the restaurant owner kind of forces Chef Carl's hand and makes him serve a really predictable and uninspired menu.
Mm-hmm.
And so the food writer lampoons him kind of on
lambastes
him. That sounds very culinary.
it does, yeah.
On Twitter. Carl kind
well,
of
also in the paper.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah,
him in the
yeah,
paper,
yeah.
But then it gets picked up on the review goes viral because it's so bad that people are laughing at it.
Yes,
you know, like it's so scathing.
Yeah.
That people are kind of like laughing at it and then sharing it with their friends because they're like, oh my God, this guy must really suck.
Carl kind of unwittingly gets into a Twitter war with him. He barely knows what Twitter is, but he ends up in a kind of online.
His son
feud.
Teaches him what Twitter is.
Yeah, which is a great scene.
But only enough so that he just doesn't understand it. And yeah. He thinks he's sending a DM when actually he's posting something publicly.
Right.
And it turns into a big problem.
And so
big PR disaster.
Yes. It escalates to the point where Carl invites the critic back to the restaurant so that he can cook the food that he originally wanted to the first night. Again, and he prepares to do that, but then again, the restaurant owner kind of intervenes and basically fires Carl, or Carl walks off the job. Mm-hmm. And his sous chef or one of his cooks steps up to run the service, and they serve the exact same menu that was served the first time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And the critic is expecting like a completely new menu.
Yes.
Because they've challenged him to come back and try the actual food.
Yeah.
But then he gets served the exact same menu and then he just sits there with this like weird look on his face, like, what is happening? And then, but when he gets to the end of the meal, he, you know, just posts something on Twitter to say, oh, well, I came to try the new food and they served me the same menu.
Carl didn't show up.
I got the other night.
Yeah.
He says Chef Carl Casper was a no-show.
And then because he's talking to someone who works at the restaurant during service on the phone, he knows that the critic is wrapping up his meal and he sees what's put on Twitter. And so he drives to the restaurant to confront the critic in person.
That's right.
He storms into the dining room and makes a big scene, which, like you said, is captured on all kinds of cell phones and put online and goes viral, even more so than the original bad review.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's like, you know, it's like a hissy fit tantrum, which is like the people's favorite thing to virally share online.
Yes.
Yeah.
So now Carl is a laughingstock and he's out of work. And the personal backstory that we haven't even touched on is that he's divorced and has a kid. Maybe I can't even remember, an 8-year-old kid, a 10-year-old kid, 10-year-old.
Yeah, 10, I think. Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that his son says that he's 10. Okay. I can't remember his son's name. What is it? I can't remember.
Percy.
Percy, that's right, yeah.
And then what happens? He has a good relationship with his ex-wife, I would say,
yeah,
all things considered. She is from Miami, and I think they met in Miami. Carl used to work in Miami. That's where he got his big break as a chef.
Yeah.
She needs to go to Miami for business or something, and she suggests that Carl comes and basically acts as the nanny to his own son. That's how Carl sees it.
Right.
Spends time with his son in Miami. And I can't remember if this is something they talk about before they get there or not, but she has eyed up a food truck for him. She's really eager. His ex-wife, Carl's ex-wife, is really eager for him to operate a food truck.
Well, she's really eager for him to do his own thing, I think, like the kind of the main thing that she, you know, that she feels would be like a step forward for him.
Yeah.
And her sort of like idea of an easy way for him to do that is this food truck idea that she has. And he thinks that the food truck idea, or like he, you know, looks down on the food truck idea because, you know, he thinks it's beneath him.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Or something. In fact, there's like a line in the very beginning of the movie where his son is like asking him about the food truck or something. He's like, oh yeah, well, mom says you should get this food truck. And he's like, I'm a chef.
Yeah.
You see me driving around in a food truck?
Right.
No, I work in a restaurant. I serve great food, mm-hmm. not slop off a truck or something, you right. know, like something yeah. ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But basically, it turns out that in inviting him to Miami, it's basically like his ex-wife kind of like coercing him into a situation where he's going to be like in Miami with her and her ex-boyfriend, who is the one who has this food truck.
Yes.
And he's like, I don't know, a really rich guy who's played by Robert Downey Jr.
Right.
He's like super weird.
Yes.
It's pretty funny. Actually, the way that his scenes are written, I really enjoyed, because they're like, the way he talks is like he's having four conversations at once,
yeah.
but whichever sentence comes out of his mouth, you have no idea which conversation it like
yes.
belongs to until he like completes
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Then you have to guess which conversation thread he's picking up. It's like so perfect. Like, it's such a perfect characterization of some people that I have met before, where just like they're talking about three different things, but intermixed with each other, and you can't make sense of any of
yeah.
it. Yeah. It's pretty funny.
I thought for sure when you said it reminds me of certain people who I have met before, I thought you were going to say who have done a lot of cocaine.
I mean, yeah, actually, probably. Yeah. I didn't necessarily make that connection, but yeah, I think that's pretty true.
I can't remember, like, so he gets the truck and decides this is what he's going to do. I can't really remember what the, like, epiphany moment is where he really decides to do it.
I mean, I think it's a few things, you know, like, gets to Miami, he's, like, having a good time with his kid.
Oh, he eats his Cubano after the club.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
The thing,
yeah,
right?
They take the, that's right. That's exactly what happens.
Sorry, I forgot that.
Yeah. 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 So they take, he and his ex-wife take their son to this, what's that kind of music called? That Cuban, like, jazz situation? I can't remember what it's called. Anyways,
couldn't tell you. I don't know.
They go to this club. Her uncle or something is in this band.
I think it's her dad.
Oh, it's her
dad?
Yeah,
like it's Percy's grandpa, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah, fair. I wasn't quite sure. And then, yeah, they go out after the club and they're in this restaurant and they eat a sandwich. And Carl Casper's like, oh, man, these sandwiches. Like, if only we could bring something like this to L.A. And his ex-wife is like, oh, yours are better.
Mm-hmm.
And
he's like, yeah.
And then I think that sort of like kind of gets the gears turning. And then he's starting to think about it. And he's like, well, I could do that on a truck. And then he goes and checks out this truck.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then his sous chef calls him, and he tells his sous chef about the truck. And mm-hmm. or no, it wasn't his sous chef. It was just like one of the cooks that he worked with, but who was like a real keener.
Yeah,
who was played by John Leguizamo. He gets real jealous that Carl Casper is going to open a food truck, and he like flies out to Miami and meets up with him somehow without knowing where he's going to yeah. be. I don't know.
Yeah. And he
just like in the movies,
because he's Cuban or he's Puerto Rican maybe or something. He like,
I think, yeah,
I don't know
yeah.
if he's Cuban. Or
I think
what.
He might be Cuban. Yeah. Yeah. I can't remember. Yeah.
So yeah, now they've got their team is Chef Carl. I think John Leguizamo's character is Martin.
Oh, I don't remember.
And Percy the kid. So there's the three of them running the truck. Mm-hmm. They fix it up. They start cooking. It's received very well in Miami. But they need to get the truck back to Los Angeles, right?
Yeah. And so they do this road trip.
Yeah.
And like the last third of the movie is like this road trip where they stop in a bunch of cities and sell a bunch of sandwiches mm-hmm. and have a great time. And there's like some montages. And...
some montages happen. yeah.
To them, some montages.
There's some cameos by important food people. Like,
oh, yeah, totally.
Aaron Franklin in Austin sells them some briskets.
Yeah.
Is there anyone in New Orleans?
Roy Choi is a producer on the movie. I don't think he's actually in it, but the Koji food truck is in it.
Oh, really?
When they get back to LA.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So they get back to LA and there's lots of lessons learned, lots of life lessons and cooking lessons.
A few. Yeah.
and a relationship between a father and son is strengthened.
Yeah.
And then they get back to LA.
And then we get to your fairy tale ending. Yeah,
and like, they get back to LA and then in 5 minutes of film, he reconciles with the food critic. The food critic bankrolls a new restaurant for him where he has complete creative control and he gets back together with his ex-wife. Boom. The end.
Yeah, no, you're right, actually. The fact that it ended, like, okay, so I thought maybe you were making reference to the what's kind of happening well after they get the food truck up and running and they decide to bring his son on their like road trip and his son is like actually like really pitching in on the truck and helping cook sandwiches and mm-hmm. and it also turns out that his 10-year-old son is like a social media genius.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Which isn't that unrealistic.
No, honestly. I don't think so.
And so his son is like posting their location on Twitter and stuff, and because he already had so many followers because he blew up because of this viral thing that happened to him.
Yeah.
They wind up, you know, getting a whole bunch of customers in every city that they go to. And then while they're traveling, his son is like, you know, posting vines and then making these other videos and stuff to post.
Mm-hmm.
And Carl's not really paying that much attention to it. And then it's sort of like I think the night before, is that when they're in Austin? Can't remember when they're in Austin, or it's like the night before they're going to leave to go back to LA, and they're like sitting on the truck and they're watching some live music. Also, actually, there's a couple live music scenes in the movie, mm-hmm. and the live music scenes are really great, mm-hmm. like really amazing. Reminded me a lot of Treme.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But yeah, so they're like finished service, and he and his son are sitting on top of the truck, and he kind of like, you know, he's really feeling connected to his son, and he's like really feeling like happy that they've been able to strengthen their relationship. But he wants to be honest with his boy and like let him know that like when they get back to LA, like his kid's going to have to go back to school and he's going to be working on the truck all the time, trying to make the truck successful and stuff. And so he sort of like tries to gently break it to his son that like when they get back to LA, they're not necessarily going to get to hang out on the truck every day. And that, you know, mm-hmm. and his son's kind of like, yeah, but can I just like work with you on the truck when I'm not in school or something? And he's like, you know, I just don't want to make any promises that I'm going to have to break. So like, I don't think that's how it's going to be, you know, like mm-hmm. you're going to be in school and you're going to be living with your mom again. And mm-hmm. I'm going to be busy with work. And I just want you to sort of like understand that that's the situation. And then when he gets back to LA and drops his son off at his mom's place, it's sort of like this kind of bittersweet goodbye. And his son is kind of like a little bit sad because he feels like, you know, their road trip is over. But he sends his dad this video that he made that's like basically a montage of like a whole bunch of stuff that they did during their road trip.
Yeah.
And then Carl Casper goes home, opens the email, checks out this video, and it breaks his heart. And so then he calls his son on the phone and is like, look, it might be kind of difficult. And obviously you're going to have to like do all your schoolwork and stuff. And it's got to be okay with your mom. But if you want, you can work on the truck
right
in the evenings if that's something that you want to do.
Yeah.
And like that part of it, even though it was somewhat contrived, like that part of it really got me. Like, got me the first time I watched the movie. It really got me this time. I was like, oh man, it's a little bit weird that I think that he thought that would not be possible before they got back to LA and he watched the video,
right?
And somehow the video like talked him into it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I sort of feel like the road trip would have been the thing that made him feel like, oh, well, like, you know, maybe we can deepen our, like, maybe this doesn't have to end right, when we get back to LA. So it seemed a little foolish that he even had that conversation with his son in the first place. But, you know, I was pretty happy that, you know, he found a way to, but yeah, then when the food critic shows up with the truck and then offers to open a restaurant for him. And he's just like, you know what? Sounds like a great idea, actually. And then the next scene is him and his ex-wife getting remarried in the restaurant. I was like, couldn't they just continue to be really good friends who used to be married? Like that relationship in the movie, I felt really worked. And you don't see that a lot, you know? And I guess when you do see it, yeah, like I guess maybe the expectation is that eventually they'll get back together. And I was a little disappointed that they did, because I thought it would have just been like cooler and maybe a little more realistic if they just like remained friends. Oh, and also she's like, I don't know what her job is exactly, but she's some kind of like social media influencer or something. And she has like a PR rep and all this stuff. And then like it in the end of the movie, like when they get back to LA, she's working on the truck with him.
That's right. That
strained credulity, to be sure. I was just like, maybe she would hang out near the truck, but I don't think that lady's going to be handling cash. Like, I don't know.
It's about the family show.
Mm-hmm.
That's, and I think,
which was pleasing to me.
Like, but it's fine. But yeah. They're getting back together. Like it implies that what was wrong with their relationship was his old job or the old way that he approached work. Right. And once that was fixed, then everything magically.
And I think they do lay some groundwork for that. Like, think that, you know, like it's in the beginning, like the reason why she's pushing him towards the truck thing and stuff is because, she like feels like he's kind of been a slave to his career, and that if she can talk him into doing something that's like, you know, a little more low key, but that's still going to give him the, you know, creative outlet that he wants, that, you know, like that could like magically sort of like fix their relationship. Mm. Also, like in the beginning of the movie, he's like sort of dating the restaurant manager or something, and it's Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
are you about to say that Jon Favreau is not worthy of both Sofia Vergara and Scarlett Johansson in the same movie?
No, I like Jon Favreau is a genius. And so like any woman would be, I'm sure, lucky to have a relationship with Jon Favreau. I don't know. Like, or maybe he's a really bad guy and I just don't know about it. But it's not, I don't know, like that part of it didn't really, I mean, I guess a little bit. I was like, really? is he really dating Sofia Vergara and Scarlett Johansson? Like, really? A little bit, but I don't know. I guess like I suspended my disbelief for that part of it. But I don't know. It just seems kind of weird too, because they had like in the beginning of the movie, he and ScarJo have this sort of like, what seems like, you don't like that?
I just wasn't ready for it. Like, I don't know.
Sorry. yeah, it seems like they have this kind of like casual sort of like dating thing going on. But it also seems like they're pretty good friends and like obviously they work quite well together.
Yeah, and she seems understands him very well. She eventually reveals like, that she understands what he needs better than he does.
Yeah, totally. And she gives him, like, I think the sort of like his ex-wife is sort of like trying to convince him in a roundabout way. Like, I think his ex-wife is sort of like trying to pull like an Inception on him,
right.
Like make him think that he came up with a great idea that, you know, that it then turns out was like, you know, sort of her feeding him the idea. Right. But Scarlett Johansson really gives him some straight talk,
yes,
about his relationship with his son. Mm-hmm. And I thought like that was one of my favorite parts of the movie too, where she's just like, look, like you need to reassess what you're doing and you need to like reconsider how much like, you know, time and effort you're putting into this thing that's making you very upset, mm-hmm. you know, like that being his career, and maybe focus more on like, you know, trying to make your relationship with your son like healthy. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was like, yeah, that was one of the best parts of the movie to me, or one of the most honest parts of the movie, I felt mm-hmm. like, which was cool.
Yeah. The way that he spent time with his son and the way that it changed over the course of the movie was really well done. Like they talk about it explicitly, like how when he's only seeing his son, when he's working and he's only seeing his son a couple times a week, like he tries to do the most fun, like they're on roller coasters and they're going to movies and stuff like that, but they're not really connecting. They're not really interacting. They're just,
yeah.
Yeah.
And his son calls him out about it too. Yeah. Which is really cool. Oh yeah. Because he starts asking his son about Twitter one night because all these people are talking about him on Twitter because of the bad review. Mm-hmm. So he starts asking his son about Twitter, and then his son is like showing him how to sign up for a Twitter account and get on Twitter, just giving him enough information so that he can hang himself on his own petard. Yeah. But yeah, like when they're doing that, his son is like, wow, this is really nice. We're like actually doing something together. Yeah, like
trying to figure stuff,
you know, like,
out.
Like I'm teaching you something. We're just hanging out and we're exchanging information and we're talking with each other. And he's like, yeah, we do fun stuff all the time. We like go to the movies and we go to the amusement park. And his son's kind of like, yeah, I mean, that stuff's fun, but it's not like how it used to be when we all used to live together and we would just like hang out and mm-hmm. do stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, good movie. And there's some good cooking scenes in it. There's quite a bit of stuff too where I'm like, nah, that's not really. There was a lot of stuff around the restaurant where I was kind of like, this is obviously like, this is only this way because they need it to be this way to set up to put the plot machinations into effect, you know?
Are you talking about the relationship between the owner and the chef, or?
That's a big part of it for sure. Just okay, so there's this thing that and it happens quite a bit in like cooking movies and TV shows where like the movie kind of opens with Chef Carl Casper like cooking in the kitchen in the restaurant, and he's just like sort of in there by himself and he's doing a bunch of prep, and then people start to show up for their day at work. Mm-hmm. And he's cooking. They know that the critic is coming in, and he's cooking a bunch of food because he wants to completely overhaul the menu. Mm-hmm. So, like, I don't know. Maybe he's been thinking about this menu. Maybe he's had a whole bunch of ideas for a long time and implemented none of them. And today he's just going to cook all of his ideas and then implement them for the full dining room that evening or whatever. And I have been in restaurant situations where you can overhaul a menu for like a single diner or a single set of diners mm. or something, but to completely change all of the food that you have on the menu to completely different food, a completely different menu, is just not
in one shift
the way. Yeah. You probably can't prep everything in one day mm-hmm. that you would want to and have it be good, you know, or have it be the way that you would want it to be, unless the menu is like extremely simple to execute and nothing required being cooked overnight or sitting overnight in the fridge before you can cut it or anything like that, you know, which there usually are plenty of things that you have to prepare that way. And then also, just like, to me, the thing that bugs me the most about that when it happens in a movie or something is that you have all of this other product that you have on hand for the menu that you normally would cook. So what's happening to that food? Are you just going to throw it all in the garbage, or just you'll go back to the old menu tomorrow and use it right, up? I'm just not quite sure how that's supposed to work itself out. I know it's a little pedantic, but like, I don't know. Just every time I see that in a movie, it just kind of like rubs me the wrong way. I'm like, okay, you just woke up today and you're going to completely change the menu.
It would kind of take, well, unless that's what the movie is about, it would kind of take some of the steam out of the story though. If it had to be like, you saw him writing.
No, that's exactly what I mean. You know, like it's obviously just that way because that's the way that they need it to be for the plot. Yeah. But just like as a cook, I'm just like, okay, like this guy's crazy.
It's just, yeah, it's like one of the, what's the word? Like, it's just one of the tropes of movies about food and cooking. Like the same way that there's parts of Westerns that are not realistic at all, but it's like part of the history and culture of the media form, not how it actually works. Yeah.
That's 100% true. Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure when most people watch those movies and those types of like plot machinations are in place in like cooking movies, most people are probably like, oh yeah, huh, it's just gonna change the menu, that's how it works.
Okay, so what do you think about this? So like when a movie comes out and it's able to pull the curtain back and show you something, like get rid of those tropes and like lazy stereotypes and stuff like that and show you something that's a lot more true and gritty, that movie often gets noticed. So like, you know, old spaghetti Westerns, people get shot and they fall off the top of the building and everything. But then like a movie like Unforgiven comes out and the deaths are all like long and bloody and like drawn out and excruciating.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, this is like ripping apart the Western genre and stuff. So maybe you need to make that for cooking movies where to change a menu.
Does that exist?
It takes 2 weeks because you have to consider procurement and write prep lists.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it happens in Ratatouille too, right?
Yeah,
like like a couple of times, yeah, and then it happens again in Chef, like the second time that the critic's going to come. I mean, like theoretically, in that instance, they're just going to cook the new menu for them. Well, no, I don't think so. I think actually they're planning on serving their new menu to the whole dining room, the new menu that they're going to serve the critic when he comes back. To be fair, in that instance, the chef stayed there overnight cooking the whole night to like try things out to get them ready for the whole night, for the new menu. So that one, you know, they put a little more thought into it anyways, I think, when it happened that time. But yeah, then the other thing that like kind of really bothered me is that, the restaurant owner is played by Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the first time that they're going to change the menu and the critic's coming in, Dustin Hoffman's like, no, no, don't change the menu. You have a menu that works. We've got lots of diners. Only one of them is a critic. The diners are coming because they love your food. Just cook your food the way that you've been cooking it.
Yeah.
And he kind of like cows John Favreau or Carl Casper into cooking the regular food. And then that's why he gets ripped apart in the review. Yeah. And then, you know, like all this other stuff happens where the review kind of starts to blow up online, which doesn't really have much to do with the owner. But the owner almost certainly read that review. And then this critic's going to come back and somehow the owner, when the critic is coming back, thinks that it's a good idea for Carl Casper to cook the same menu for that critic. Like, how is that going to help? And then that's the thing that kind of sends him over the edge where he walks out and you know, leaves the rest of the crew there to cook the service that night or whatever.
I
thought that was kind of dumb. Like, what restaurant owner would look at that review and then the next time that critic's going to be in, be like, let's give him the same menu. Like, that's just stupid.
I understand what you mean. So first of all, that the restaurant was busier than it had been in a decade or something that night.
Right.
And I don't know.
Because of the flame war.
The flame war?
Yeah, the Twitter war.
Is a flame war a phrase that I should know?
Yeah, you don't know that phrase?
Put it on the list with ScarJo, okay? I'm just kidding.
Done.
Flame war is the same as a Twitter war?
Yeah, flame war is like when people are mad at each other on social media and they go back and forth.
Okay.
Yeah.
So yes, it was because of that. We know that. I could see it being hard for someone of the restaurant's owner, sorry, the restaurant owner's age and experience and generation, like not really believing that that was the source of it, maybe. And also just like, I don't know. I think that if someone's working, has worked or owned the same restaurant for decades, like you could see them becoming like entrenched and even to the point of like being delusional about, mm-hmm. I understand what you mean.
Yeah, you're right. Like there are a lot of, and that restaurant like isn't necessarily really, like at the beginning of the movie, that seems sort of like the restaurant isn't necessarily really doing all that well.
No, but it had a name for itself, right? Like it, mm-hmm. and
but it's just sort of like doing like mediocre business, I think. And then, yeah, I think you're right. You know, like it got busy because of some like social media stuff, and maybe the owner saw dollar signs because they suddenly had a packed dining room, right, or something, and he didn't want to risk it by serving food that might not go over well or something. I guess you can explain it. There is like there is the thread of motivation there, mm-hmm. but to me it just seemed like the kind of thing that between a chef and an owner would be much more of like a conversation and much less of a like, no, you're not changing the menu. Like, I don't know.
It sounds like you've worked in very enlightened workplaces then.
Maybe. Maybe I'm lucky. The other thing that kind of confused me, which I thought was really weird. Okay, so, and it's sort of surrounding that whole thing. Chef Carl Casper wants, like, he's got a fire lit under his butt. He wants to prove this critic wrong. He's never felt more passionate about anything in his life. He stays in the restaurant overnight cooking this brand new food that has a bunch of like Korean fusion type of elements in it and stuff. And then he feeds it to the cooks when they come in for their shift in the morning. And they're like, whoa, you were here all night cooking. And they try a bunch of stuff and they're like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then they're like, okay, yeah, well, this is what we're going to serve to the critic or whatever. And then Dustin Hoffman comes in and is like, no, you're serving the old food or you're leaving. And so then Jon Favreau gets really mad. Jon Favreau gets really mad and he walks out. He doesn't really storm off. He like kind of walks out and sort of expects like some of the cooks to come with him. And then the guy who's his sous chef sort of says, well, no, I feel like I need this job. So he just kind of stays to cook service, which makes sense. And then Jon Favreau like goes home and he like cooks his anger out at home. He's got like he's got all these like ingredients that he had bought to cook this like menu for the critic. And so he takes them home and then he starts cooking in his like in his kitchen in his apartment, and he cooks like, I don't know, like 18 or 20 dishes.
Yeah.
And then he gets on the phone with the restaurant. Someone calls him from the restaurant to let him know what's happening with the critic, that they're serving him the same menu. And then he on the phone, he's like, keep the critic there. Oh, yeah, I think it's Scarlett Johansson. I think it's ScarJo who calls him. And he's like, keep the critic there. I'm coming. And like when that happened, I was like, he's going to bring this food that he cooked at home and just walk it into the dining room and put it on the critic's table and be like, here's the menu I wanted to cook for you, but the owner wouldn't let me or something. Mm-hmm. But instead, he's got like all this amazing food, 20 dishes that he just put all of his spite into. And then he just leaves that all at home and then goes to the restaurant and just charges into the dining room and starts berating the critic for, for being a mean critic or whatever. Right. And, you know, destroying chefs' lives or whatever. And I don't know what else what does he keep saying?
The molten lava
cake. He keeps picking up the molten. Yeah. He picks up like three molten chocolate cake off three different customers' plates. And he's like, look, it's molten. And then he also keeps saying, you're not getting to me. he says it like six times.
That's what, that's what makes it so pathetic that it is just.
Oh, it's pretty well done. Yeah. But I was like, I don't know why he went home and cooked all that food and then got on the phone with the restaurant. And then I don't know, for some reason in my head, I was like, he's just going to cook the menu anyways. And then he's just going to like march it right into the dining room. But that's not what happened.
Yeah, I didn't think about it that way, but his montage of him cooking his anger is kind of like an 80s dance movie, like where you just like you dance your anger out like in an abandoned warehouse.
Exactly.
Kind of. Yeah. You just brought up loads of amazing, really great points. I have to talk about something in this movie, though.
Okay.
There's this one scene where Percy is watching TV and they show the screen for like 3 seconds. Uh-huh. And it's a movie about there's a cat shooting like a turret gun at a bunch of soldiers.
Yeah. I rewound it. It's so amazing. It's like a YouTube video or something.
Oh, is it?
He's okay. Like watching some random video, I think. Yeah. Oh my God. It's so amazing. Yeah. It's like a war movie or something, or it's like like an action movie. And there's a shot of a whole bunch of people getting shot up, and then the camera switches angles and it's like this cat and he's like shooting the machine gun, and then when he's done shooting the machine gun, he kind of like licks his chops or something. Oh my God. So funny.
Is that a real video that exists that they just put into the movie, or did they make that for that movie?
I wish I knew, Alan.
One thing food wise that I really liked about Chef is I liked the lazy menu. Like I liked the lazy, predictable menu.
Yeah.
Do you remember what that, like the menu that the owner kind of forces?
Yeah.
Him
the caviar
to
egg.
Yeah.
And the,
there's a seared scallop, I think.
Yeah. I can't remember everything that's on it.
What I remember is the caviar egg, seared scallop, filet mignon, or they just say filet. And the molten lava cake.
Yeah.
Whereas the exciting menu is the one, like, you don't really get to see that much of it, but yeah, it has something with gochujang in it. It has some kind of the like citrus and like Puerto Rican, Cuban flavors that he works with later. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really interesting because the lazy menu does sound very lazy to me, but like, it just kind of speaks maybe to how cyclical and trend driven the industry is.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting that they laid out that menu so clearly, and that it was, for people who are in the know, it was supposed to be like a oof, I can't believe they're serving that.
Especially the chocolate lava cake, like is, you know, like that's just a real stab in the heart.
But it's funny, you know? Because of course that can be great.
Yeah, it can be an amazing dessert. But yeah, it's so old and overdone and done so badly a lot of the time that, yeah, that's what it has come to signify, I feel like.
And maybe like
in the industry,
relying on like really premium ingredients or really expensive ingredients that have a cachet that don't actually require that much technique, like say a seared scallop or a filet mignon. Like obviously there's technique involved in preparing them properly, but like as opposed to even say like the pork in the Cubano sandwich, where they're like marinating and braising and there's a lot more going on than just searing a filet.
Yeah, and you can see and like I think that they do a good job in the movie of like outlining that in how he's like cooking when he's like preparing the food for the new menu and stuff. Like shots or like the scenes that they have of him cooking like really show the difference, I feel like. Like the food on the boring menu still looks good. Like it looks nice, like food that you would expect to see in a fine dining restaurant that was maybe a little bit out of touch or something. But the food that he's cooking for his, like, you know, the stuff that he wants to cook with his heart, and the new menu that he wants to present is like, you know, all this, like, yeah, like you were saying, like really fresh, like citrus, and I don't know, like, yeah, they're bringing in whole animals for it. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, I think that part of it, whoever consulted on the, I wonder if it's Roy Choi. But yeah, whoever consulted on sort of like the content of the actual cooking scenes, I feel like did a pretty good job of representing that to people in the industry or people that are in the know. To really sort of like sell the idea that like, you know, there's this food that still looks good to most people, but the chef finds it really boring and this is the stuff that he wants to cook. And
right.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I made a bunch of notes, and yeah, like one of my notes is that I wasn't sure about the ending. So it's funny that you brought that up first thing, because
they did, like you said, they do lay some groundwork. But it's very fast.
It just shouldn't have ended in a wedding. It should have just ended in them being great friends and him being really appreciative that she helped him out to sort his life out, you know, like.
Oh, sorry. The two, to me, the the bankroll, the angel investor bankroll,
mm-hmm.
And the marriage. It was a double whammy of like, what? Really?
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I almost bought the food critic, like, angel investor angle. Like, I don't know. I kind of feel like, because they also laid some groundwork for that. The critic, when Carl Casper was in the beginning of his career, had written a bunch of really amazing things about
yes.
him. Yeah, and said true. That he was like this amazing up and coming chef. And I think so the critic like really wanted him to succeed,
yes.
but was just really disappointed when he was cooking this boring food and he felt like, you know, maybe tearing into him would like wake him up. Well, it turns out.
neither of them were impossible.
Just together and yeah, like.
And quite rapidly, yeah.
It was a little, you're right. It's very like suddenly everything works out.
It was the inspiration for the last season of Game of Thrones.
Ouch.
Timely. No, that's really time appropriate.
Topical. That's what you're looking for, Alan. Topical. Okay. So our plan was to talk about two movies.
Yeah.
And honestly, I don't think we're going to get to Big Night because there's just so much about Chef that is fun to talk about. I think we will have to come back in another episode and talk about Big Night because that movie is also fascinating.
Is it going to get a whole episode, do you think?
I don't know. I don't know if it can sustain a whole episode.
I could do an entire episode on Stanley Tucci.
I mean, maybe if we keep going off on tangents the way that we have been. I mean, really, we only need about 5 minutes of content that's actually about the Big Night or actually about Big Night. And the rest of it can just be about stuff that we cooked one time. Okay, so when he gets the food truck, it's filthy.
Like comically.
It's just
filthy,
like horrible. Yeah. It's comically dirty. And he's there with his boy. He's like, you know, babysitting his boy, and he's like, okay, well, we have to clean this truck. And his kid's like, what? Like, we have to clean this out? Anyway, his kid winds up being a pretty good sport about it.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, you know, cleaning some stuff. And at one point, he's been told to clean like a whole bunch of stuff. And then he's been doing it for like, I don't know how long, like a half an hour or something or an hour. And then Jon Favreau comes back and he's like, oh, you don't have to clean that. We're throwing it out.
Right.
And he clearly had like told him like half an hour before that he needed to clean everything, which is totally a chef move.
That the whole cleaning the truck thing, like it showed his Chef Carl's like kind of imperious nature. Like he's just like very commanding and like, I say this, you do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's treating his son with that same like sort of like tone and attitude that he would, you know, treat a trainee with, mm-hmm. which I think he's doing on purpose to kind of like, you know,
toughen him up, teach him something.
Well, not
teach
just him- to toughen him up, but almost, yeah, like to teach him something, but also in a way, I think he's doing it to include him.
Right.
To make him feel like he's, you know, like he's a part of the team and, you know, he's doing something important for his dad that, you know, and it needs to be done because they have to clean this truck. And, you know, like he's like a cook and his dad's the chef and he looks up to his dad or whatever.
Mm-hmm. He's still kind of a jerk.
No, yeah, he is. Yeah. I agree. Especially, and this is what I wanted to ask you about. So there's something really bad. Something that smells really bad on the truck and they haven't figured out what it is. And at some point, Percy opens this like fridge that his dad asks him to clean. And there's like a hotel pan full of food that's like, who knows, 2 years old that's been sitting in this fridge rotting. Mm-hmm. And so Percy opens the fridge door and he almost throws up because it's just like horrific. And then his dad's like, take it out, you know, we got to clean it. And he's like, you want me to touch that? And his dad's like, yeah, get rid of it. So he like pulls it out. Percy pulls out the hotel pan and then he like throws the whole thing in the trash. Yeah. And then Carl gets really mad at him for throwing it in the trash.
Right.
Because you don't waste anything. And that's not what we do. you know, like we have to preserve everything and we don't have money to just be throwing away hotel pens.
Yep.
And I was just wondering, Alan, if you were in his shoes, if you would have cleaned that hotel pen.
If I were in Carl's shoes, would I?
Yeah. If you were in Carl's shoes, would you have found it necessary to clean that hotel pen, or would you have taken the whole hotel pen and thrown it in the trash?
I think it's highly unlikely that I would throw a hotel pen out.
I thought you might say
like
that.
It, and are you more worried about like the unpleasantness of cleaning it, or like some kind of food safety thing? What do you? What's your hesitation for cleaning out the hotel pen?
It's more about like how disgusting and filthy it was, and then also the time that it's going to take to get that hotel pen back into the shape that it would need to be in order to be able to reuse it safely, mm-hmm. like you said. Mm-hmm. I just, like, I don't know. To me, like, they're, like two scenes later, they're in, like, the kitchen outfitter store, and they're buying, like, 100 pans, and they're buying a new stove,
yeah.
and all this stuff, and I don't know. Like, when I saw that happen, I was like, no, I would have thrown that hotel pen straight in the trash. Just get it out of my face.
Right.
We'll clean the truck. I'm not going to worry about that hotel pen right now. I have to go buy a stove right now anyway, so I'll just buy a new hotel pen. Yeah, okay, it's going to cost $3, but...
You buy hotel... Okay, tell me who your restaurant supplier is.
Oh, that looked like a cheap hotel pen to me, too. That's the other thing. It looked like a really cheap, thin aluminum hotel pen. If it had looked like a sturdy, like stainless steel, like... it would depend on the hotel pen.
Shale, there is nothing in a restaurant supply shop that costs $3. There is literally nothing.
Oh, well, yeah, I know that's true.
You know how...
But the restaurant supply shop that they were in was like not... It wasn't like a...
It was like a chop shop for restaurants?
Yeah, kind of. You know, like it wasn't like... a restaurant supply like conglomerate where they have a warehouse and you have to call someone and you're like, do you have this in the warehouse? And they're like, yep, we'll put a PO through for you. You can pick it up in 6 hours whatever. You know, like it was like, there's just like tons of shelves just full of stuff. And I've been in stores like that.
Yeah.
John's. And you know, sometimes you can, yeah. Or like, there's this great kitchen supply shop in Vancouver. What's it called? Mingwo, I think. Mm-hmm. It's in Chinatown. And they have like really amazing stuff in there. And not everything is cheap, but they also have like, you know, commodity sort of like cooking implements that you can get for really cheap if you need to. Mm-hmm. And like dishes and stuff that are just like super cheap if you need them. And yeah. So yeah, I've been in shops that are kind of like that. You're right. You're not going to get a $3 hotel pan, but still like $12 probably.
I'll look into it.
Okay. We'll put it in the show notes. I'll find a $12 hotel pen, Alan, and it will be in the show notes.
A new $12 hotel pen.
Yeah, brand new.
Okay.
It's going to be a hotel pen. It's going to conform to the shape and size of a hotel pen. But it's not
going to
be.
And it's going to cost 12 doll hairs.
But yeah, I think I can find one for $12.
Okay.
So there's that. I probably would have thrown that hotel pen in the garbage. I'm sorry if I'm disappointing you, Alan, but that's just how I feel about it. Also, there's like one point where John Leguizamo is like talking to one of the other cooks in the kitchen and he calls him Amuse Douche. I don't know why I found that so funny.
Yeah, I remember that. I like that. Yeah.
I thought it was pretty funny. Like that's an actual, like, that joke doesn't come out of the head of someone who hasn't worked right. in a kitchen, I don't think.
Oh, okay. Speaking of depiction of kitchen culture, one strange thing that's like kind of made to be a joke, but maybe wasn't really fully explored. The guy who was the sous chef for Carl, at Galois before Carl was fired / walked off and became the chef. There's a lot of references and allusions to him being a raging alcoholic. Like being drunk on the job and like having to like drive his car to the parking lot of the restaurant to sleep in it and stuff. And it's like kind of dealt with in a like, oh, it's just like this charming thing about this guy that he is alcohol dependent. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, kind of like not totally unrealistic and like in a weird way. And also like, I don't know. There are a lot of high functioning alcoholics that work in kitchens.
Yeah. And I imagine there's lots of people who might work with them and know it, but not.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, yeah, just go with it.
And I guess like, that's kind of the Bourdain story or something, you know, or that's sort of like what Bourdain kind of like traded in his early career is like this idea that you can be an addict or you can be a misfit or you can be, you know, like, but as long as you're there to make sure that you do your job and that if you care about the food, then, you know, people are willing to put up with whatever.
Right. Yeah.
And Bourdain tells a lot of stories like that in his books about, you know, like, you know, being, you know, totally tweaked out all night and not sleeping at all and then just showing up at the restaurant in the morning and then cooking all day and then going out and doing it again. And I've seen that in restaurants that I've worked in. You know, I've been like close to being sucked into those types of situations sometimes at some points during my career. Never really had any situation where I was like afraid that I was going down a dark path or anything, but definitely like did some things that I probably shouldn't have in terms of like going out and drinking with staff or something, you know, the night before I was supposed to work the next day and that, you know, doing things that probably weren't healthy. But yeah, they definitely touch on that and don't really lean into it too much. So I don't know. So then what is it supposed to be? Is it just like a character trait of this guy or are they actually trying to say something about it? Yeah, you're right. It's kind of weird.
I didn't necessarily mean to suggest that like they owed more to that character because he's like a tertiary character at best. But it was interesting that it was shown and then just kind of we moved past it. Yeah.
And the other thing like that I really felt like while I was watching the movie is that they did a good job of sort of like, I don't know, like I feel like, you know, working in restaurants and cooking culture tends to be like kind of connected to other sort of like cultural things that are happening, like either in the same city or things like that. Like they did kind of like a good job of like showing that there's kind of a connection between food and cooking and restaurants and then maybe like, you know, music or live music in a city and how those things kind of like intermix and, and you know, like I think that part of it is like quite realistic. Like those kinds of connections usually exist. I think partially because a lot of people who are in like artistic careers, like, you know, like people that are trying to be musicians but maybe aren't making a lot of money doing it wind up working in the service industry, and so there's connections there. And then also because of, you know, because restaurants, you know, deal a lot in like capitalizing on nightlife, there's always like connections there too. And I thought the movie did a really good job of just like sort of showing how those like different cultural worlds are kind of like this one single fabric, like especially when they go to Miami and they go to the dance club and then they go out to eat afterwards, and it's just like it sort of feels all connected.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, there's certainly like even outside of nightlife, like lots of the places that we've worked, like the business is tied to other events that are happening in the city life at large, right? Like,
Yeah. Anyways, so you liked it?
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, me too. I liked it. Good movie.
This is like, I don't know. This is like maybe one of my kind of 90s fantasies living out, where like, are we kind of Siskel and Ebert right now? And we're giving it two thumbs up?
Oh, yeah, because we can't use thumbs up. We have to use some kind of dumb cooking thing. So
three forks out of four forks.
Yeah, exactly. I give it five fried eggs.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sudeby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.